Good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Peter Vandersteer. When I was getting dressed here this morning, I thought I would mention briefly how I came to be here. And there's a number of threads, but probably initially it's because I showed up at Zen Center in the early 70s just to see what it was like. And in the process of being there for a period of, I think, about 12 years, maybe a little longer, kind of full time, I got acquainted with a number of people who are sort of family to me, are very much family to me. Isan was certainly one of them. He actually opened the front door when I arrived. One of his standard routines in those days was buffing the hall. He was running this waxer around the hall, which I think he liked to do at least once a week. And there are many other people who have really had an impact on me over the years that I encountered there. And so, in some ways, out of appreciation for the effort they are made and are making, and my interest in all that, this sort of why Mio invited me here. I spoke a few times before, and it's always interesting to me to see, you know, having been involved and been interested in this for all this period of time, if I actually have anything, you know, new or interesting to say about it. So there are some familiar faces and some new faces, which I'm always happy to see. I'm always happy to see people that are just sort of curious, and you never know, you know, how they're gonna hear things or respond, and people who are pretty much, you kind of think that they're gonna be with you on this project for a long time. So in thinking about my topic, and maybe I should inquire, traditionally these talks run, what, half an hour? Is that about right? I thought I would talk about the precepts. And in this, one of the things that's true, I think, of Buddhism is that they have all these lists, which I can never remember. You know, the 12-fold chain, maybe I can recall 7 or 8 of them. It all makes tremendous sense at the time, but it doesn't stick. I don't think that that's necessarily a problem, but anyway, that's how it is with me. And if someone had asked me, well, what are the 3 pure precepts, just, you know, somebody on the street, I don't know if I could have said for sure, but they're the initial part of the Bodhisattva precept and lay ordination and priest ordination. And they are, I vow to refrain from all action that creates attachment. I vow to make every effort to live in enlightenment. I vow to live for the benefit of all being. I think attachment is a pretty interesting topic. It's certainly something that it's easy enough to understand and sort of agree with in the sort of general, you know, I mean, food, sex, money, recognition, these are easy categories to agree. Yeah, these are sticky. These are sticky things. But, you know, for each of us, we have our own particular mix. And I think what is really evident is in the course of sitting, just by sheer repetition, you get a very relentless burst of reminders as to exactly where you are obsessing, where you are struggling, and that's, I think, tremendous background. I think it's really tempting for us all to view sitting and meditation practice as an education. We're learning stuff. But I actually am not sure that that isn't kind of a sort of a fixed idea that perhaps doesn't stand up all that well over time. Certainly, I think it's noticeable that a lot of people who have sat for a long time are still struggling with very familiar challenges. One of the things that occurred to me on the subject of attachment is, you know, trying to investigate the origin of them or the rationale or whatever is maybe not that useful. In the sense of, if you're trying to figure out the creation of them, you know, you can think about your history, you can think about whatever, but it probably is more useful just to notice the attachments you already have in the process of your everyday life. And of course, everyone has their own particular versions. For me, a real classic example of attachment might be how people, say a party of folks at a restaurant, respond to the question of the check. And, you know, certainly, you know, some people, for example, myself, I really do not like to, in a sense, dicker or go back and forth with people. I'd rather say, well, this is a $40 event. There are 10 people. You put down $10 and a tip, and that's that. And there are other people that would really feel, no, it's appropriate. I didn't get a drink, and they want to work it out that way. And of course, they're completely appropriate approaches, but they certainly reference very different relationships to whether it's money or sense of equality or who you are in the world. I mean, you still may be reacting to a vow that you made at the age of 7 that you will never struggle the way your mother did over, you know, clipping coupons or whatever. You just could care less about that. So for me, that's an interesting study. And then the question of looking at attachment is probably most vividly highlighted in relationship. I mean, the example I gave is pretty straightforward. You know, you're responding to a particular circumstance, but how you relate to all the situations in your life. Are you attracted to only known and familiar situations? Do you put yourself into relationship with people that you really don't know that well? Do you do you tend to push boundaries in terms of how you talk with people, or are you happy just to get by with pleasant conversation? I think our relationship to some of this stuff changes over time. You know, when I was younger, I had various ideas. Like it was really important to speak only the truth. It seems like a reasonable idea. But it can be kind of boring. And it also can be like people wonder, like, what's with this person? He's not saying anything. And I still have some of that tendency. You know, it was just an idea that I had. And particularly if you're someone who, such as myself, who maybe more inclined to try to work things out on your own rather than talk it over, that's a very strong tendency. That really will kind of keep you in a certain track of relationships and so forth. And what I notice now is it's not like it's such a good or bad position. It's more like it's not quite as fierce or firm as it might have been in my 20s or 30s. And it is true, you know, these days I can meet people and talk about ultra mundane. You know, there may be a little sparkle in the conversation or not. And that's great. It does not have to be consequential. So getting back to the idea of the precepts, I think, of course, it's, you know, because they seem like standards, they seem like, in a sense, you could associate them with rules. I think it's easy to think of them as strictures rather than kind of background. I think it's easy to see with people who are really struggling, perhaps, what the precepts might be about. I have a young son who is working very hard at sort of establishing his life in various respects. And his impulse is to be very energetic, very fast, very confident in a way, and not so unlike myself maybe at an earlier time, he is pretty much willing to say anything, either to be charming or to just try it out and see what happens. He doesn't seem to have a feel for the stickiness and the potential reverberations of language. He doesn't, I mean, obviously this is something that comes with age when you realize I've lost that person, you know. I just raged at him for a little bit, and you know, 20 years later there's still not much connection. So those experiences, I think, are how we all kind of get a little bit more, I just say conservative, but or even cautious, but at any rate, maybe perhaps a little bit more measured in the realm of talk. But I think it's really interesting with the precepts in the background to notice our behavior, notice our relationships, in just the little particulars of how things go. So one of the things that I notice some of these days is how I sound to other people, for example, on the telephone. Every once in a while, I might be having a conversation, not even a conversation, maybe somebody's calling me up and he is interested in having a conversation and I am not interested in having a conversation. Maybe he has got something really wonderful that he wants to offer and I'm convinced that it has no use or interest to me. There's an acceleration of my pace. I can push that conversation forward, and there's a little bit more energy on my side, like, don't you know that I'm not automatically available to you? That's the implicit part of my response. And so, you know, it can come across, and maybe in fact is rude. So just hearing that quality, I think, is useful. And I think in the realm of what our days are like, just noticing things like pace, a real common and interesting realm for me is driving. in my work, I have occasion to get around town frequently, and I drive a motorcycle, so I have, in a sense, a lot of flexibility. I have a lot of, in some sense, there's a lot of ease, because I can go around obstacles, and I can, I'm not encumbered in the way that a lot of folks are. And I have an attitude in my driving that is reinforced by that. But noticing your relationship with other drivers, you know, one of my great analogies in driving are New York cab drivers, and how on a big avenue going down four or five abreast, it's sort of like schooling fish, you know. They all understand the rules, they all know how to move. It's quite wonderful, you know, sort of like they kind of enjoy what they're doing sometimes. Sometimes you can be driving and you're clearly not enjoying it. And there's a fair amount of psychic exchange in traffic, you know. You notice who is like pushing a little bit more than you think appropriate, who might move into your lane. Who's actually going to go first into the intersection, and what you think about that. So I think that's pretty revealing about just, in a sense, that's a kind of a meditation check. What is your situation? What is your state here? And as I sort of mentioned before, I think it is our attachments to certain style, certain pace, certain kinds of circumstances that really keeps our lives pretty much on rails. So those are just the kind of temperamental container. And I think that in the process of sitting and practicing with other people, I think we also have an opportunity, and I think most of us do take the opportunity to really kind of review our history, our particular history, and explain our challenges and our limitations, our struggles in those terms. And it may be, I think it's probably also useful that we, perhaps to a certain extent, because we do experiment with it, because we do try out in practice different contexts. You know, if you practice full time in a temple, you may have an opportunity to exercise various roles. And if you're working in the kitchen, you have many exchanges all the time. Someone is telling you how to cut the carrots. You're pretty sure you know already how to cut the carrots, but they would like it a little different. Or you have the responsibility for planning a meal, and your style of cooking is just to go to the refrigerator and get what's there and put something together. But now you have two or three people you're supposed to organize their activity. And all that kind of challenge is great, I think, for examining, you know, your positions and your personal history, how you like to do things, and the utility of how you like to do things and the limitation of of that. We certainly find, I think, a lot of opportunities, not just for examining our attachments, but obviously the flip side, our aversions. And I think with both, but probably, I don't know, more, but certainly substantially, to a substantial degree, in terms of aversion, I think sitting, just because it is a very simple, almost manageable commitment to just stay put for a particular period of time. Gives us a tremendous range to examine, you know, our attachments and aversions. And because we can't get out of them, in a sense, we're staying with them in a way that we might not otherwise. Certainly for many people, our lives and our culture provide endless opportunities to change the channel and not notice a lot of both our attachments and our aversions. I was sitting with a group of people recently, not in a meditation hall, but in a sauna, and there's a few people who simply cannot stop talking. It's like they don't notice this, or it's never occurred to them. There might be other people who have something to say. But it's, you know, I mean, I'm sure we are familiar with people like this. Perhaps there are some circumstances where we're playing that role. And of course, being thoughtful and considerate Buddhists, we rarely object. But on this in this particular context, this is a different era, but there was a wonderful gentleman who was capable of really astonishing comments. Some of them really embarrassing. But on one occasion, there was a kind of a heroic type of athlete explorer talking about doing something in South America. And this older gentleman said, you know, a little bit of you goes a long way. It was just so completely to the point. I mean, just, if you didn't, I don't know if anybody laughed out loud, but it was just one of those wonderful moments. So I think, you know, that's a really an excellent meditative comment. Lordy. The second, we were talking about the precepts, were we not? I vow to make every effort to live in enlightenment. And so you might actually wonder, and I think it is an interesting question, you know, what is living in enlightenment? You know, there's a lot of opinions. One of the things that I do notice is that it seems to me that to get a real satisfying slant on that topic, you do have to have been around quite a while. You might be just old and have seen a lot and not been impressed by much of any of it, or someone on the other side of the scale who has kind of a bhakti approach. They've noticed a lot of things to appreciate over time. All those, I think, are relevant, but it's in my experience, it takes a fair amount of experience and perhaps a real sense of discipline to have anything to say on that topic that's particularly satisfying. One of the responses that Suzuki came up with was to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. And one of the things that I think is a very common challenge and inevitable is I think it's completely natural and inevitable that we all start sitting with the idea of just sort of hunkering down and getting smarter. I mean, it just seems like so obviously what it's about. And since I, you know, we keep getting told these simple things, and I think we slowly wake up to their veracity, is that there really is no enlightenment, or there is no real anything outside of a relationship. So it really doesn't matter so much what you think or what your interior life is, or how smooth your state of mind might be, how you and others relate, how the mix goes in the challenge of moving around in the world and dealing with others, seems at its most fundamental the only realm. And so one of the things that I notice, it feels like, and perhaps I'm growing more appreciative of, is just the intelligence of others. It is amazing what, you know, some people's gifts are. I was at a meeting, I think earlier this week, and the person conducting the meeting just had an extraordinarily clear and inclusive way of processing business. In this context, it's a board, so there's the rules of order or whatever they are. And ordinarily, I think of this stuff as just no big deal. But somehow or other, it was really palpable how much this person was able to include what needed to be included, clarify and summarize, and just move on. And another of the people there is a teacher, and just a gift for language. And so he could put things in a way that was not only accurate but funny and light at the same time. This is great. The third of the pure precepts is, I vow to live for the benefit of all beings. What would that actually be? I'm always struck by, I think particularly, this may sound a little glib, I don't know, but sometimes people who are younger, perhaps ordained, and they seem to be very frequently engaged in what I would call concerned and compassionate talk. You know, and they speak of love, and they speak of heart, and they speak of all these things, and obviously it's all relevant. But I try to think if I have really been moved or inspired, and by whom. And the people that really got to me, it was different, you know, it was different. And, you know, Isan is a particular classic in my mind. I don't remember anything preachy ever occurring from his sector. And yet, there was very few people in that community, and this was a very extensive group of people who were all the way up and down the social scale. Who knows where they were in terms of maturity or not, in terms of ambition or not, in terms of delusion or anxiety or fearfulness or whatever. For whatever reason, or for myriad reasons, he could always include these people. There was no one, almost without exception. I mean, I've seen him. I'd seen him get cranky. Certainly seen him get flustered. I studied tea with him, and he always struggled with his, what I guess what I'd call sort of the formal, you know, his ability to remember stuff or whatever. And yet, he also was completely, I don't know, completely is a little strong, but anyway, quite comfortable in a way that I think was rather unique with who he was. So if their struggles were there, that was not a problem. You never had to worry about him. You never had to feel sorry for him, regardless of what his condition was. So that kind of a gift, I think, has much more to do, because with the business of living for the benefit of all being, because he was somebody that everyone could agree was benefiting them. So for me, that's a wonderful thing. And I think, you know, I think it's, what I think is also true about the precepts is they are wonderful questions. You know? When Suzuki was asked by some student or other, what is a priest? I think on one occasion at least, he said, well, I don't know, go ask Katagiri. And Katagiri was asked the question, and Katagiri said, I don't know. And I think that is a very, very useful position. I certainly don't know myself. I'm here in this uniform. I don't really appear in the world this way very often. But I am interested enough, you know, in what that might be to put them on, worry about, you know, doing it correctly. And all the forms, you know, of that go with it. I find them interesting. I mean, I certainly have spent years objecting to some of them. Service, for example, I think there's lots to, in a sense, resist. But that's just interesting, you know. Just, well, why do I mind? Why should I care whether we're chanting this way too slow? But, you know, I have my positions. And when, you know, the latest generation starts messing with the service, I'm shocked. So, you know, that's what I'm investigating. So I guess I talked longer than I needed to, but I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you all for showing up, being polite. If you have any thoughts or questions we could talk about briefly, I'm always interested. Yeah?
I was interested in your point about responding to telemarketers, and I assume that's what you were referring to. Because, and I have one thing that I've done, and I still feel that irritation, but it's like, well, could I have your home phone number, please? I'm a little busy right now, and I'll call you back later.
Uh-huh.
They don't respond to that.
That's it.
And the other thing I've noticed where I can get very irate is with those computer-generated loops where you're trying to call, and you just get one ping, and they go, I don't understand what you're saying. Repeat. And
then
I just start yelling. I'm like, shut up!
Yeah, it's true.
So it's a pretty interesting feedback mechanism. So thank you for bringing that up as a practice observation.
Yes. Yes. I think one of the more poignant examples of that for me is when I'm talking with somebody in India, and you think about what a thankless job that must be, to deal with speedy, impatient people worldwide calling you up and hammering on you because you're not able to resolve whatever mess they've made of their you know, situation. That must be murder. And sometimes, you know, I in general, I'm a little better with that, but I just, I notice that there are ways and ways, and, you know, it's actually pretty good and surprisingly effective to just tell folks, I am not interested, thank you. Often that is sufficient.
Yeah, but then I'm pretty slow when I get on the phone, and they can just kind of start overriding that. Well, and then I'm like,
right.
So, but yeah, you're right. I just don't pick up the phone, which is what I usually do, is screen calls.
Yeah. Well, the computer dial thing, there's always a pause, which I don't even wait to, you know, to conclude. It is true, I don't think you have any obligation to be polite to a machine.
No, maybe. I don't know. Somebody must be listening to that somewhere.
You think?
Maybe.
You might be a machine in your next life.
And another point was, I really appreciate you bringing up the Esau memories, and I just remember him, lots of memories of him, but the one that kept coming up was him giving a lecture over here. He's right in the middle of the lecture, and then he stopped and he goes, I don't remember what I was talking about. And he got everyone involved, going, oh, it was this, or it was this. And I was like, that is so cool. Rather than being that's what gave
that's
the power over to people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Enough? All right. Thanks very much.